sharing their wonderful space with us. I'd also like to let you know that the ASUA bookstore is here with books of Gerald Stern's for sale. I'm sure he'd be happy to sign them for you after the reading. So they're set up near the doorway, if you didn't notice, on the way in. Gerald Stern is the author of 8 books of poetry, including The Red Coal, Paradise Poems, Lovesick, Leaving Another Kingdom, Selected Poems, and most recently, Bread Without Sugar. A new collection, Odd Mercy, will be published by Norton next year. Since 1982, he has taught at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and last year was honored by the Academy of American Poets with their Fellowship for Distinguished Poetic Achievement. Milosz has said that the poet is a person who differs from others, in that his childhood does not end, and who preserves of himself something of the child throughout his life. The marvel of Gerald Stern's work is that the quality of childlike wonder cohabits with a sober adult intelligence. An earnest student of life and of death, of poison and wild strawberries, Stern watches everything with fascination and great heart. Reading his poems, I get the sense that if one's attention could be keen enough, it would heal the world's injustice. Perhaps that's too much to ask of poetry. This I can say with assurance. The world has been made more beautiful because of these poems. Please welcome Gerald Stern.
Thank you very much. That Milosz's thing about children reminds me of something that happened to me a number of years ago in Eleanor Wilner's and Bob Steinberg City, Philadelphia, Filthydelphia. I was there. It's kind of a fairly long story, but I don't want to make it. I could go on for an hour with this story, but I'll make it very quick. I was asked to write a poem. I don't know if you were living in Philly before. John Sebastian Bach's 300th, or I guess it's 300th birthday. It was a complicated thing how I was asked, because, you know, I knew the guy was going to call me. He was from the Mellon Bank in Philadelphia. And he had been with the Girard Bank in Philadelphia. And the Mellons bought out the Girards, and he became useless president, vice president in charge. And he loved music. He loved Bach, and he called. And somebody called me and said, "You're about to get a call to write a poem for this, his 300th birthday. And would I do it?" And I said, "Well, yeah. How much is in it?" He said, $1,000. I said, "That's not a lot of money to write a poem. I've never written a poem to order like that. You know, Auden did that. He was very good at that." I said, "All right, we'll work it out." The guy called. And he said, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, back and forth. And I said, "Okay." Obviously, he's my favorite composer, which was a lie. And I said, "How much?" He said, "Well, would $1,000 be?" Okay, I said, "Yes, but I'll need $1,000 to read it." "Oh, of course." So I doubled the fee like that. So I went there, and we went into downtown. You know, we had lunch at this club. I guess it was the top floor of the Mellon Bank, 18 floors or 400 floors. And there were a lot of photography and more. I remember that then. And he was studying. There were two or three people I was with. And this banker kept studying us. And finally he said, "I've got it. Poets are like children." Actually, I was with a poet who was kind of a foolish guy. And he was acting like a child, somebody that Eleanor knows real well. I won't mention his name. Well, I'm going to read mostly tonight, if I may. Partly you read for yourself. That may sound selfish, and of course it is. You want to read, you want to try new poems out. I'll read a few older poems. For those of you who don't know my poetry, for example, it doesn't really matter. You'll hear a new poem, you'll hear a new, and I think those who do know would be interested in seeing what I'm doing now. I don't want to give a comprehensive reading situation like this where, you know, two from this book, three from that book, and as if it's a class in, Poetics 907 or something like that. But I do want to read a couple of poems from this book called Bread Without Sugar, and I may return or I may not later to a couple of poems from my selected called Leaving Another Kingdom, all for sale out there at very low prices. And so let me just do that. And then I'm going to read mostly recent poems. These will be in my next book. And they are not bound, and therefore it's a little difficult to get to and to remember, so you'll forgive me for being awkward. You should forgive people for being awkward. I'll read a poem called Nice Mountain. I wrote this in the central Pennsylvania, in Perry County, which is the only county in Pennsylvania that does not have a red light. They're hillbillies there. I mean, everybody there, they're kind of, you know, the police are afraid to go into the western part of the county, give you the stateies, stay out of there. They sort of let people run their own show. And I have a friend that has a house there, and I wrote this poem for, it's a birthday poem, in front of his house, in front of a dogwood tree in the middle of winter, which happens to be when my birthday was that year. It changes. It's called Nice Mountain. Great little berries in the dogwood, great little buds, like purple light scattered through the branches, perfect wood for burning, three great candelabra with dozens of candles, great open space for sun and wind, great view, the mountain making a shadow, the rifting behind the weeds, great willow, great shoots, great burning heart of the fields, nice leaves from last year's crop, nice veins and threads, nice twigs, mostly red, some green and silky, nice sky, nice clouds, nice bluish void. I light my candles. I travel quickly from twig to twig. I touch the buttons before I light them. It is my birthday, 200 years. I count the buds. They come in clusters of 4 and 7. Some are above me. I gather a bunch and hold it against my neck. That is the burning bush to my left. I pick some flaming berries. I hang them over my tree. Nice God, nice God. The silence is broken by the flame. The voice is a kind of tenor. There is a note of hysteria. I came there first. I lit the tree myself. I made a roaring sound. For 2 or 3, I had a hidden voice. I try to blow the candles out. Nice breath, nice wagon wheel, great maple, great chimes, great woodpile, great ladder, great mound of tires, nice crimson berries, nice desert, nice mountain. The guy whose house I wrote that poem in front of is a sweet, wonderful guy, poet and translator, translates from Portuguese and a couple named Kerry Keyes. I don't know if you ever come across his poetry. And he lives in, I don't think he'd mind me telling this story. I'm just so you get the flavor of what central Pennsylvania is like. I was talking to someone yesterday, but they said, geez, it sounds like Arizona, where people drive in trucks with guns. And I said, yeah, well, Pennsylvania, except for Philly and Pittsburgh, is all rural. It really is. He lives in the woods, and he has a house. He has an outdoor toilet. And to have an outdoor toilet, you know, in Pennsylvania, where it gets very cold in the winter, is a feat, frozen feat. And I was talking to him once about his first wife, whose name is Anne. And we were standing outside the house, and I said, why did Anne leave? Because Anne left. And he said, that was years ago Anne left. He said, she wanted me to build a toilet inside the house. I says, you're kidding. I mean, such gall, you know? What'll they want next? Yeah. I'll read a poem, another poem from this book. I'm going to read a poem later about the Ukraine. So I'm going to read a little poem called Ukrainian. I woke up one day, three years ago, discovered that I was no longer a Russian Jew, that I was a Ukrainian Jew. I mean, in the old days, you called someone born anywhere from Riga to Siberia a Russian in the good old days. And so I was a Russian Jew, though my father was born in the Ukraine, in the hills, in the country, and my mother was born in Poland, near Lithuania. And then these countries started to become independent, and I woke up with horror. I was Ukrainian. And I mean, I say this with love of all my fellow Ukrainians, but I felt kind of strange. I had to get used to it. It takes time to become a Ukrainian. And I'm going to read a poem in a little bit. Maybe I'll read this one and then go into that new one, which is the second one I'm going to read is the one I just finished this afternoon, called Essay on Rhyme. This one is called Ukrainian. It's a very simple, short poem. And there's a memory here about my father who believed in vinegar. Vinegar was the magic elixir. He thought that vinegar taken internally or externally would do everything necessary for you. Say you're on a beach and you had to have a sunscreen, vinegar. Say you had an upset stomach, vinegar. And it's cheap and it's available. And it's a universal panacea. So the poem touches that a little bit. There's a redbud tree in here. Do you have redbud trees out here? Oh, they're beautiful trees. They're sinuous and just in short. They're about that big. And they're just terrific. Okay. So it's a very simple poem. It's called Ukrainian. Before I go outside, I daub my face with vinegar. That is Ukrainian. I put one drop behind my knee and one on my earlobe. I choose a bush. If there is a flower, I scatter a grain of sugar on the twig to help dying worms. I pick a weed. I prop a rain-drenched tulip. There's a part of me that lives forever. Spring after spring, I sit at my redwood table. At this point, the grain is white with age. The boards are splintered. The hole that held a grand umbrella is bent or twisted. Nothing could fit there. Yet I'm enchanted. I sit on the bench, one of two, half curved. The table itself is round. It measures more than a yard. The end boards are split and shattered. I have one favorite tree and one favorite bird. I lift my cocoa. Water is all around me. I make a pact. If the tree lasts one more year, if it blooms next spring, if the flowers that cover the twigs and fill the sky come back again, I'll stay here another winter. I'll plant a garden. I'll trim my branches. I'll rake my leaves. The cardinal who lives beside the red bud, he whose crimson is richer than that pink, he who almost shames the tulips, he whose carnal cry is always loud and florid, he is my witness. And then I'll read, I'll come back to one more poem there, but while we're on the subject of the Ukraine, I'll read this last poem in this book, which may or may not, but I don't know how this got so wet. It's soaking wet. Is there something in the back seat of your car, Patty? It's called Essay on Rhyme, which of course, you know, there have been a lot of essays on rhyme. Alexander Pope wrote an essay on rhyme. And Carl Shapiro wrote an essay. It's spelled R-I-M-E when you do it that way. Most of the essays on rhyme deal with poetics and form and dynamic ratios and relationships of form and content and the history of poesy and such. You may or may not find that in this poem. It is two pages of five five-line stanzas, five-line stanzas. It's still in the working stage, but I'd like to read it to you because it's about the Ukraine. God knows those apes, my father's relatives, born in the Ukraine and raised on white cheese and herring, will live till their 120s. So I will be careful when I tell my Ukrainian stories and check all the cities from Novgorod to Dallas. God knows they lived on a small farm owned by ethnic Germans and cut trees down and studied for only a month a year in the autumn and one in the spring. God the trumpeter knows that one of them owned a stogie factory in Pittsburgh, and one was a dentist in Michigan, and one had a perfume shop on the Rue Madeleine and drove a Ferrara. Because of his luck and where he was sent to sojourn during the first days of the war, one of them ended up in Florida, filling prescriptions and later cashing checks. I, who have the brains in the family, I ended up on a wooden porch arguing with a swallow and wrestling with a bluebell. My plan is now to live in three places, maybe divide my books and maybe divide my time. One of my houses will have to be near Turkey, since that is a way to get back to the Crimea and the Sea of Azov. And I have chosen Samos only because Pythagoras rebuked the petty tyrant Polycrates there by the waters of Ambulos. And I could have a cat who eats his catch behind the wet rocks and shakes his rear leg and read my American subscriptions and rant as I did when I was 20, even if I was alone, though I would be, I think, surrounded as always and listen to the sound of waves assembling and count the intervals. Even the druggist, even the perfumist would understand that, wouldn't they? My rich cousins who burned, the one at Nice, the other at Coral Gables. I, who sat and slept for hours and knew the white crests and the brown valley they meant. And I, who loved the sun just as they did and burned from the same fire, I sang with my broken fingers. The cousin who's the perfumist is the interesting one. His name is Shimmy Grossman, and he lives in Paris. He's been there for maybe 50 years. He stayed there after the war and had a shoe factory. Somehow he got some money, and then he had a perfume shop. And my son and I were in France a few years ago. And I said, you got to visit our cousin Shimmy, and we did. His French is sort of like my high school French was, though his children are French, you know. It was charming to be with him. And that's Shimmy. I'll read one more poem from this book, and then I'll read mostly recent stuff. I think I'll read a poem called, that's a kind of a traditional narrative in a way. It's called The Founder. I just feel like reading that poem. And this is a very simple poem. I have a friend who lives in the East. His name is Carl Sterner. He's a sculptor. And when we were young instructors at Temple University, where I taught and was fired from, for I forget what, 80 or 90 crimes. I think one of them was insulting the president. His name was Gladfelder. He was a real asshole. We used to go out to the country on the weekends, and one time, just look for things, you know, and look for trouble, buy things, steal things. We found this incredible head of a bronze head, a statue, and we wanted this head very badly. And nobody there to pay. So we sort of borrowed this head for a few years and put it in the back of my station wagon, and we took it to my house, and it sat there and for a long time. Well, as I describe in the poem, my friends who were graduate students and young instructors would come with it. There was a sledgehammer beside the head, and they'd smash the head to get even with authorities in their life, you know, priests, parents, high school principals, whatever. And then, but of course, it's a kind of Orpheus poem. The head is Orpheus. He is singing. The two major tales of Orpheus is one of him turning back, you know, to look at Eurydice. Everybody knows that one. And she disappears like that, as she does in Cocteau's movie, and so on. And that particular myth, forgive me, doesn't interest me a lot. The other one interests me a great deal more, where he ends up after he was torn to pieces by the Maenads because he was more interested in his own music than in them. I think that's why they tore him apart. He floats down a river, and he's just his head is singing. And Apollo, who was insanely jealous, the way poets are, you know, because Orpheus got better publications than Apollo, he said, "Turn to shit," you know, and that was it. And that was it, and Orpheus never sang again. So that's the part, that's the myth of Orpheus that I like. I think it's a very interesting myth, and I think there's a lot in it that has not been explored yet. The other one is just done to pieces. So it's a shortish poem. It goes like this, it's called The Founder. Now The Founder, of course, is that head that founds a department store or church. It's Carnegie, it's Rockefeller, it's Vaughan in Philadelphia, you know, or, I don't know why I'm talking about Philadelphia so much, Kaufman in Pittsburgh. Who's out here? Who's a founder out here? Somebody, there's got to be a couple. Name? Goldwyn?
Goldwater.
Oh, Goldwater, yeah, whatever happened to him? Is he still there? There's a kind of drooping bronze head I stole in the Catskills and put in my living room in Philadelphia. I put a sledgehammer beside it so my friends and I could smash him and change his shape from thoughtful oppressor to tortured victim. This was just to show the close connection between the two, the liquid life of capitalism. We got to kick him. We got to gouge his eyes out. We were elated, breaking his nose and flattening his ear. It was a kind of funeral rite. Sometimes the hammer hummed in our hands. There was a jolt. His pain was in our wrists. Sometimes we were exhausted from so much pounding. After a while, his face was old and twisted. It was a little full. I finally sold him. By the pound, I think. He was too ugly for us, too demented. We were starting to turn to pity. We pitied that bronze bastard. He who must have presided over the burning of mountains, he who managed the killing of souls, the death of every dream. I reached inside once to get the brain, but it was only rough casting in there, nothing to suck on, even though the cavity was widened at the base of the skull. He was a brainless founder. His eyes stared at the wall. Or if we turned him around, his eyes stared with a kind of wonder at the dining room table catching the pools of beer. I remember it wasn't all raw socialism and hatred of the rich. There was a little terror in it. I think sometimes I got out of bed early and put a towel or a t-shirt over his face to cover his eyes and his ugly deformities. Just for a while, a mutilated ancestor, someone we had buried twice, a monster, something that could ruin us. It took an effort to put him on the back of a station wagon and free ourselves from fright. I had to struggle, although I'm sorry I sold him. He deserved to be buried somewhere. I should have driven to one of the dumps and thrown him into a valley between a sofa and a refrigerator. Or just gone into the woods and made a grave between two birches and shoved him in. I'm glad there wasn't a river. I would have dropped him down in the muck with the black Budweiser. In one cold spring, the current would have carried him through a park or into a muddy backyard on top of the poison and the wild strawberries, or carried him into the open, his crushed head going faster and faster
turning around in the garbage, his face forever swollen, his eyes squinting, the sorrow coming from his metal lips, the sun shining, the melodies never ending.
I took that. Thank you. I showed my friend Carl, who was with me when we were, you know, young guys, that poem, and I said, what do you think? He said, it's wonderful. That's exactly, except one thing. You did not sell that painting. You gave it, sculpture. You gave it to me, and I put it on my back porch in a place called Germantown, which is in Philadelphia. And the kids, these are real poor kids, stole it. I said, they stole it. Suddenly, as soon as you have a little property, you forget, you know. Give a guy two stalks and he forgets, you know, that he was on the other side once. All right, I'm going to read some recent poems. I'm going to start off by maybe five or six poems. I'm going to start off by reading very recent poems, ones I've just written. Well, let me read a poem called Fleur. I'm trying to read things that I didn't read to anybody in this audience in the last few months, but I have you have an audience. This is a poem about a flower, about my garden in the back of my house in Iowa, and it's written about a year ago. Because it takes place in November. Is this November? October. Well, it'll be, I'll read for a month or so. So it's called Fleur. No sense lying. My own two rows of pom-poms are still alive, even in November. The frost of October 12th meant nothing. Here I am watching marigolds in the dark. Can you believe it? What do you think they look like? Why was I denied those little buttons, those small orange clusters? These are like trees and branch and divide. They cover my daisies. They ruin my iris. There's a forest here. How can I scoop the dirt up with my own nails and rend my hair? There isn't a single thing here for me to love. I feel belittled. Where are the leaves? How can these flowers live without leaves? It could have been the snapdragon with swollen blooms and dark spots in the throat. It could have even been the daisy. Lord, they grow to supernatural heights, but there is a wisdom somewhere. I could have walked through daisies sucking my cheeks. I could have lain like a swan with eyelashes intact and pulled the fleurs. They are called fleurs. She loved me all that morning. She loved me not. She hates me. She despises me. She was my lily. She is or was my lavender. She was my delphinium, short and blue. I count my fleurs. I have a way to go. I see me walking the borders. My hands are in my pockets. The railroad ties are planks. I turn to the left. I am ready at any minute to plunge into the marigolds and rub my hair with maroon fleurs. Or I am ready to cut one or two branches and bring them inside. I have a bucket of orange and yellow. I add some honey and marjoram and bitters. I can rinse my face when I want to, say, all winter. And I can start next time with flats, some crown of gold for early rising, some yellow cupid for roaring, and bury whatever is left out there, three stalks with curled, dried up leaves and heads bent down like rubber mops, and one small dragon, its throat painted scarlet, and three or four ox-eyed giants with fleurs, like impoverished nails, like filed teeth, hanging on, I guess, to love. She loves me. She loves my crumbling leaves. She loves my spikes. She loves my broken stalks. She loves my mop. And I love hers, though mostly I love the light that comes from her, her emanation. Did I ever think I'd say that? And the coneflower that rotted for two or three weeks, I love that. And how my fate was sealed, by which direction the stem would fall, and whether the head would drop before the leaves, and how she knew it, my fleur. There's a lot of eastern flowers in there, I realized, but what the hell, snapdragons, to daisies, you know, she loves me not, all that stuff. Well, let me read a couple of short, I guess they're meditations. They're lyric poems, really, mostly a page long. You know, less, so they're relatively short. This one's called Picking Asters. It has a sycamore tree in it, which you have out here. Although your sycamore is different than our sycamore. Yours is more sinuous and has bifurcates into branches, and ours goes straight up. But it's the same skin, the same leaves, it's the same tree. It lives by water. And it's very, very human, this tree. I've written a lot about it. It takes shapes that are very human. It bows, it bends when it hangs over rivers, right? You know this tree, the sycamore? So it's called picking asters. Now he knew the sycamore was imitating him, holding its one leg under a rock, bending to wash its face. He no longer fought the mottled trunk or smashed his hollow stick against its thighs. Even when he hung his steaming wash rags on a lateral branch, a left arm in the air, he did it gently, almost as if to warm those muscles. Life was precious to them both now, one hanging over a river, one in a slatted chair, one at his tea, one at God knows what kind of muddy beer. He saw it coming. He was ready for it. And he could have sat for hours just staring. But he was starting to imitate the tree, a sycamore. He threw himself into his stretches. He screamed at the river. High up, maybe on the road, it might seem funny, the man stretching and shouting, tree still and bent. But on his face already there were signs of pain. The act of him picking asters, the act of him keeping his right hand out to keep his balance as he bowed. If the tree itself were not bowing like that, if there weren't asters planted in its nether paw, you'd say he had to be foolish. If he weren't barking, if he weren't trying to catch his breath, you'd say he was dancing. These are sort of blues songs, my kind of blues. I mean, Ukrainian blues. This is called This Time. And, you know, there's a lot of just a quick lesson, 30 seconds or less, to permit you to enter my poetry and others like mine. I'm very loyal to the particular and the concrete and that which is in front of me. And we all live in a solipsistic universe. That is, it's so big we don't share in a significant way. There's a lot of our culture and language and such and experience that we don't share. But I devote myself to my experience, and hopefully you can feed into it and identify with it and connect it with yours and not be upset if there is a particular or a concrete thing that you don't recognize and don't know about. I try, there's a point where this is unforgivable, of course. I always stop shy of that point, he says. So this poem called This Time. That was his picnic table, and those were his two spruce trees growing so vertical you'd think there was some desperation. Say a roof eating the light up, say chimney. And those two things that flew from gutter to gutter and perched for only a second, each of them, were the black-streaked, white-faced goblins coming to eat and sing above the noise of cardinals and the humming of rubber and its echoes and the roaring of the early train. Lord, he was here again, not far from the jungle gym beside the plastic zebra. Lord, he would stare at the light bulb in front of the voltage box bolted to the untarred telephone pole. He would study the guy wire and how it stretched between the roses, the wire that caught the earth just so that nothing fell there, and dip his face to suck his tea without using his hands this time, and say his chanson in English and French the way they did 6 centuries ago without one word of rage, with reference to the lark this time and the white hawthorn beating one hand and one heavy knuckle, his tongue whacking the roof of his mouth, his musical thumb scraping across the dining room table, his pitiful slurs in front of his metal quail, his fripperies over his wooden-faced carp, his hapless ribcage and nerveless fingers,
his clumsy flutters and three or four poor staccatos. Hard time this time. I was celebrating in that poem a broken rib. You know, actually, I broke a rib in end of April, March, May, and it's still not altogether better, and I've lost all the feelings and it's two fingers. Well, I didn't lose all the feelings. I like pity. Some of the feeling I lost. Little. It's like wearing a glove, you know? Well, you know, gloves are okay. I'm going to read, three more poems. I'm going to read this one, and then I'll figure out what the last two will be. This is a poem I wrote recently. My mother, who died a year and a half ago, at age just 93, and I've written a lot of poems for her. And this is one I wrote in September, after coming back to Iowa City from a long absence in the East, in Pennsylvania. And my porch was, my place was overgrown. And there is in front of my house a little privet hedge, and there was a female cardinal who came to study me, for I was invading her territory. And she stared at me. She got so close, it was amazing, with her one eye. And as I wrote the poem, I realized, with due forgiveness, I hope, it was a kind of pietà. And that would be enough to tell you. My mother's name was Ida. She was staring at me to see if she had to move her nest, of course, you know, or if I was a piece of furniture. A squirrel eating her way in, and a mother cardinal with such an eye. She knew two things at once. In what was work for her, lower than me here, I'm sure, as close to her nest as she would allow without engaging her whole prudent being. And I saying, cheer to her. What cheer, what cheer? Breathing my own prudent last, if that was necessary, my heart going out to her. For all she knew, my feet like birds' feet, I could be her child if it were necessary, and die on a thorn, or wear a dress for her, and sparkle as rain does, and wear my sparkling beads, and wear a sparkling tear on my cheek. Or I could be as still as she wants, I could be a stone, till her eye is satisfied. She is so rough in these things. She is so sloppy. Look at her straw. So close to my mother, is that Ida? Her eye, shrewd and watching, daughter of lilac, wife of honeysuckle and privet. Ah, she has worked, and her heart is beating. She is a nurse and a scholar and an architect. Her slurred, her rocking body, proof positive. She lands on my impatience. She flies to my birch, and I lie dead in her lap, and dead in the bark, and dead in the grass stems, my arms hanging out of the nest, leaves on my chest, weeds and rootlets here and there, my stomach a little red already and a little brown, a twig in my mouth, but only by accident, for there is more love than not. And she is reaching to get the twig, and I'm holding on, which is enough for one day. Pity alone enough for the two of us, though there was grief and duty too. I would have held up a lily for her, for she is not to blame. I would have dried her tears. I did it for most of my life. Thank you. Well, there's one poem I want to read that is maybe a little long, and I think I will just read this. I was saying to a friend earlier today that poets have this desperate need to read. How could they exist without the blue poem? How could they leave this hall without having that experience in it? You know, for God's sake, you go to hear a musician, a composer, you know, and you hear three pieces or four pieces. It's genug for one day, as they say in Chinese. I don't want to, so I want you to come back when I come and read all these other wonderful poems. But I'm going to end up with a rather longish poem, which is very, very available. Geez, there's another one I'd like to read. Do I have time for two? Maybe. Do I? Okay, I just want to read one poem because this is a poem called Ducks Are For Our Happiness. And this poem is for Phil Levine, who is not here tonight. He's actually in Italy. Can you believe that? Eating blintzes. He is at that Rockefeller place. What is it called? Where you get the
Bellagio.
Yeah. And he is a great letter writer, Phil. He writes letters to everybody. I mean, young poets, you know, suddenly they get a letter from Phil. And he has this amazing collection of letters. And so he lives in Fresno. So when this is Benjamin Franklin is talking in this poem. Sort. And he's on the Iowa River walking along and very in a rage about something. You know how Ben Franklin was. And all you have to know about Ben Franklin is he wrote letters to Phil Levine, and that in the autobiography, he enters the autobiography by eating a piece of bread. Remember, a day old rolling. In this case, he's eating a Brugger's bagel. And the other thing is that when he was along in years, I mean really along in years, and living in Paris, he would court 14-year-old and 15-year-old girls. God save us. I mean, I don't know what they would do at the University of Arizona about that. But Madame Kolodny's not here. Anyhow, this is called Ducks Are For Our Happiness. I'll read that, then I'll end up with a poem called 16 Minutes. It takes about 8 minutes to read. And I'll just go right into it. The other poem is I have to talk to you a bit about it before I read it, but it's very quick. Benjamin again, down by the esplanade, watching the green ducks flapping, eating a bagel from Brugger's, sipping his coffee, eating his heart out again, remembering spring after spring, or was it love after love? He feels like a fool in spite of his letters. He likes the face of the mallard. He finds it sweet and quizzical. He loves when the sun shines directly on the neck. He loves how the mallard cleans itself. He tries to bend his neck and rub his beak on the feathers. He is angry because of his loneliness. He likes the head going back and forth. He likes the speed. It is the warmest day yet. If he could sit here an hour, he would be happy. Ducks are for our happiness, he says in a letter to Fresno. They resolve our fear of separation. I am reminded constantly of Sappho, how the heart in her ribs shook with misery, how her tongue was broken and her eyes were dead to the light. But he is determined, he says to Fresno, to put sorrow on the other burner. He is disgusted with lovers moping at his age, restless thoughts and slouching. He who started with a bun, he says to Fresno, ends up with a package of day-old bagels. He tosses a piece of poppy seed to one thin duck whose head goes back and forth as if it were on a spring. He spreads cinnamon among the sleepers. He curses what has happened to Jewish bread. But then he settles in to watch the ducks until it gets cold. His river is narrow now. It once was huge. He barely could see across. It seemed to rise in the middle, and when the thaw came, there were sometimes trees and deer and sofas floating by. This river is more like a small canal. Even the bridges are small here, but he likes how it turns on itself as if it still were looking for its outlet, and that's something. He finishes his letter and brushes the crumbs off. One green duck pursues him. It is his own voice shrieking. It stands its ground like a dog. It is the way that grief its ground. Fear and sadness combine to make him like that. He rubs his own neck raw, for this is his weakness, and dips his bill in water to try to get his strength back. Franklin, dear Fresno, tries to pet the duck and ends up running down the esplanade in reckless pursuit of his own voice, of a brawling duck, angry beyond belief, moving sideways into the bushes, sliding into the river to get away, carrying the anger with him, cries of irksomeness, agitations, dark nights of the soul, arranging the transfer to him of another's unhappiness, the water of misery he swims in as Franklin arranges the ethics and studies the slats on his bench. The ducks would die for him if they had to. They are magic, Is it the oil? Is it the feathers? And how do they know his oddities? He walks between two bridges talking French to his youngest sweetheart. He has written her letters in two languages. She read to him at night and fixed his pillows. She, of all his loves, he longs for most. He wants to watch her again, bend her head to the ground as she brushes her hair. He wants to bring her chocolate. He hates loneliness, and he hates anger disguised as pity. He could write about it, he tells the ducks. Dejected facial expressions, vain imaginations, even whimpering. The ducks only sing. My God, that is their singing. Think of that, he tells no one. Think of the ducks singing. My God, they're warbling. Their near notes and their far notes, their low-pitched chucks, their musical trills, their whistles, he says to the river. My God, their happiness, Fresno. Now let me just read, end up with this poem called 16 Minutes, and it's about 2 o'clock in, I was in Bucknell University in the spring, which is in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, and while I was there, I was taking a ride one day, and there were 2 clouds in the sky, and one cloud looked exactly like Ireland, and the other one looked exactly like Long Island, and so I'm writing about this in quatrains. Philosopher, our insane philosopher of love, who had a heart attack, several heart attacks, and died there, put there by the postal department on charges of fraud. I'm not going to say anything about the Coca-Cola company or anything like that. I'll be nice. So here's the poem, and this is the end of it, and I'll finish reading this. It goes quickly. There in the sky above Lewisburg were 2 land masses that looked so much like clouds that when 2 birds flew through them, they flew through livid chimneys and smoking hillsides. One was Ireland and one was Long Island, side by side at last. Completely forgetful of the other 2 masses, one to the east of those islands, one to the west. I parked my car as I do at a deadly corner to watch them change or come together as one more landmass, or even to join the other continents they left behind in Walmart's cloudy parking. I noted everything, including the great salt ponds in eastern Long Island, including the dark blood all over Ireland, caused, as it were, by the sun. Wild ducks flew over one place and wild over the other. Crows with strips of something hanging from their mouths flew between them. I tried, without going to the library, to unravel the history. Especially I thought of illegal landings, and I thought of the little white potato passing between them. Strange to think that they had different poets, so close they were together, and strange to think how it would be if ours were closer to theirs, or theirs were closer to us, or if they drifted together east of New York and west of England, or in the lower sky above this Lewisburg, east of Clarion, Pennsylvania, west of Bloomsburg, 3 hours from Philadelphia, 5 from Pittsburgh. Odd to think of the Jews and Irish too, how we married each other, how my own children have pink faces, how we hated each other, Jews and Irish, and fought each other, how the Jews were horrified by one thing, how the Irish were aged by another, how the Irgun on our side and the IRA on theirs both battled English smugness and deceit, how they both saw through it, and how the English were appalled by them both, not to mention the Irish down from Canada who settled in Queens, not to mention the mayor of Dublin, himself a Jew, whom I saw plant a tree in the old Sephardic graveyard on Arch Street in Philadelphia, I am sure, who traveled from Jewish place to Jewish place and planted and talked and drank and told a joke, albeit wearing a top hat, not a derby, and not a cap, the thing we had in common, certainly not a beret and not a yarmulke.
the wind, our enemy destroying a couple of counties in both good places, me not wanting to see the world in shreds, language too we had together, I would call subversive, and spoke we still another tongue, and spoke we this tongue as gorgeous strangers, and theater, I would name theater, and comedians, and actors, and lightweight boxers, and singers by the dozen, and music of tears you might call soft from time to time, and blarney, a Jewish characteristic. Mostly, though, self-reproach. We couldn't help it. One cloud turned black, and then the other. They were raking their own furnaces. There was a little crime, too, and there was the mother. We both sang, Mammy, how could we help it? Mammy, Mammy, I'd walk a million miles for one of your towels. Oh, Mammy, but God, we were different. Did I say how one cloud was different from the other? And how I sat there for 16 minutes till one islander fell apart? Truth was, they fell apart slowly. Truth was, a larger island came in view. I guess it was Greenland, or part of Alaska had mingled with Siberia and carried it my way. I almost made a new religion in those 16 minutes and a new language, Jewish, and a foggy city called Irish Aloyum. That would mean peace to the Irish. I say peace to the Irish, and I say peace to the Jews, and I say grudgingly peace to Greenland, and peace to the monster Siberia with Alaska in its mouth, and peace to the hills of Pennsylvania, and mostly peace to the inmates of Lewisburg Penitentiary, and to the Irishman there we held illegally, and Thornburg extradited as a last vicious act to make Bush smile and Queen Elizabeth chuckle. Jimmy Hoffa and the Berrigan brothers, and Green Glass the Rat, who checked his atom bomb in before they gave him a number, and Morton Sobel, who spent 20 years here because he kept his bomb in a cardboard suitcase underneath a girder on the Williamsburg Bridge, and good Alger Hiss. He came here for the air and for the food. He had a cardboard suitcase too, with a bomb inside it. And peace to that Irish Jew, Wilhelm Reich, who died inside his cage in 1957, and to the love he brought us, and to his exploding cells, and to the cloud that carried him up, and to the shawls we wore, and to our moaning, and to the stone walls we moaned against, and the we always kept track of, the moon that ruled our lives through all the killing and hounding we all but worshipped.